shot at 18 times. Whether or not these individuals and others were targeted because they were Muslim, that perception can increase fear and feelings of persecution in the Muslim community. It can elevate the attractiveness of movements like ISIS among certain people. In other words, needless violence can beget needless violence, which ultimately helps terrorist organizations like ISIS to reach their goals. We're going to spend the hour hearing the perspective of three people who are not only a part of the Muslim community, but who study the impact of these incidences here and around the globe. Dr. Abdelmadi Al-Soudi is a visiting scholar at UNC Charlotte in the school's Department of Religious Studies and a professor of Political Sociology and Middle East Studies at Jordan University. Welcome to Charlotte and to the program, Doctor.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Sam Wazan is the author of The Last Moderate Muslim, the second edition of which is now titled Trapped in Four Square Miles. He is also a global trustee with United Religious Initiative and chair of the Charlotte Cooperation Circle. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Neil Abudaba is chairman of the Islamic Center of Charlotte. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good to see you. Tensions in the Middle East have always been a part of modern life. I cannot remember a time when a week has gone by without some news in the paper, on television, on the radio about violence, troubles, tensions, things boiling over there. What started as a conflict between Arabs and Israelis, at least in the American mind, has now, in the aftermath of the so-called Arab Spring, become a kind of war among Muslims in that area of the world, with Shiites and Sunnis marking their territory and organizations like Al-Qaeda and their spinoffs, ISIS, coming to the fore. To the outsider, this all looks hopeless. What does it look like to you? And I'll begin with you, Doctor.
Thank you. Actually, this, after the American occupation of this area, especially Iraq, so it was seen as the American toppling Saddam Hussein, which is a Sunni government, minority government, mm-hmm. controlling Iraq. Then after that, 10 years of oppression for the Sunni, then they developed their own resistance against first the Americans, then a first Iraqi government. So these groups, actually different groups, the occupation of Iraq opened the way for many groups to come inside Iraq and start to, in the name of resisting the occupation, to fight each other, sometimes to fight the Iraqi. And then this development of Sunni Shia problem appeared in the Middle East before. We don't hear about it much inside the Arab countries. Maybe we can see that Iran is not an Arab country. It is a Shia, Muslim Shia country. But this phenomenon of Shia, Sunni, actually only appeared in Iraq, specifically after the American occupation. Then this Al-Qaeda came to Iraq, and then it is affiliation, different groups like Al-Nusra, then like ISIS or ISIL, now the Khilafah, Islamic Khilafah. All these groups, actually, every one of these groups has his own background, his own ideology, his own view how to solve these problems. But all of them, at the end, want to end the, first of all, this undemocratic regime in the Arab countries, like Bashar al-Assad and other countries, and then to get rid of occupation of the American occupation. And actually now they want, who will, at the end, who will dominate this area? Who will establish the last say in this conflict after the American leave?
What you're describing is a Pandora's box.
It is.
And we've opened the box and we've let things out that had been contained by Saddam Hussein and others. But I asked the question, it looks hopeless to us. Does it look hopeless to you?
It is actually now, we've seen that now, you see the area actually is really a mixture of conflicts, racial, religious, nationalist. Just name it.
It is clear. So, I'm not going to get an answer, am
yeah,
I?
Actually, this is the problem, that we don't know who will, at the end, will dominate the area. That's the problem. The Saudis, the Qatar, aiding some people. The Turkish, aiding other group. The Jordanian, aiding a third group. The American, maybe fighting with the government. Mm-hmm. So there are many actors at this moment working in this area. That's make us even hopeless. We don't know what will happen.
Sam?
Well, I am hopeful. I am hopeful because a page was turned. A page was turned and the region got destabilized by the United States or any other foreign bidders for those local politicians. So I am hopeful because under Saddam and the dictators before, there was no opportunity for people to understand how they can work with each other without having an oppressor. Mm-hmm. And when the oppressor was removed by the outsiders, then those folks who were both beaten up into submission and had no power to speak up without suffering persecution or mass murder, like the Kurds did in the days of Saddam, mm-hmm. then they began to now see how they will get along with one another. And they are ill-equipped to find a new normal without violence. And it starts from one of the root causes of turmoil in the Middle East. And unfortunately, we're not hearing that from the for-profit media. The one of the root causes of turmoil in the Middle East, why the new normal seems so far-fetched, is that it starts at home. It starts at home with the unfortunate factor of the way Arabs, some Arabs who raise those violent individuals, raise their children. And I want to make sure that we also are here before, let me digress. Arabs, we need to use our words carefully. Arabs is an ethnicity, and it includes Jews, Christians, Muslims, and other people of other faiths. One of the root causes for violence in the Middle East and the Arab world has been that children, when they grow up at the bottom of the social ladder, and the father, the tyrant, is at the top. Women and adults are in the middle. And let's say, for example, the father wants to take a nap in the afternoon and the children are fighting. The father will get up and starts beating up all the children into submission. And those children were hit, regardless of innocence or guilt. They were never raised to explore that vast range of emotions that exists between hitting and crying, between a victim or a perpetrator. They were all beaten up into submission. And they grow up like that. And they grow up to be statesmen and women, politicians, fathers and mothers. And guess what happens? They are lacking into one skill, which is compromising.
It's like the cycle of violence that we talk about when we talk about domestic violence in this country. If you were raised by an abusive parent, you tend to be abusive when you're an adult yourself.
I cannot accept this kind of description of the Arab families. This is maybe in the Middle Ages. I don't know if
I am specifically
I am sociologist. Yeah. I have three children, all of them doctors. They are raised in a good manner. The majority of the Arab people are educated now. They have universities, schools. Their fathers are busy working like any other other people in the world. And this terrorism problem actually is not because of the Arab raising their children in that way. It is because of the foreign occupation and interference in the problem. So for example, why the Arab hates America? And why they are this anti-Americanism? Is it not because we raise our children to hate Americans? We love the Americans. The Arab people, the most people who love to come to America and live to America. Jordan and Israel has now about 10 years peace treaty. No single Israeli was killed in Jordan.
And thousands of Israeli coming. You greatly, and I respect
thousands
that
of Israelis coming to Jordan every day.
Dr.
We
Saud,
did not
I
see any problems against these Israelis. Yeah. There are thousands of Americans in every Arab city. Mm-hmm. There is nothing against them. So the people who are fighting this war inside Iraq, because of there is a political issue. There is oppression from one party against the other.
That's what I'm saying.
We are civilized people raising our children the same as any other nation.
I can respect
in the world.
That, but we can preach that and talk about it in theory, and we can talk about reality where I lived, and I witnessed the forces that grip the civilians and the fighters alike. I lived there for 15 years inside a combat zone, and I observed the making of radicals. I was personally ripened for violence.
In the war, yes, but outside the war.
Where do we live now?
Only in Iraq and Syria.
Okay, so we'll move on.
Let me bring Neil Abu Dhabi into this.
I want to come back to the first question you asked. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing the worst of it or not? I think we're not. Right now, if you look at the Arab world, the region is very unstable, and it's going to continue to be like this for a long time. The Arab Spring is not really an Arab Spring. It was cherry-picked. We cherry-picked the countries that we need to see an Arab Spring in, just like Tunisia, Egypt. But we having the same problem when we talk about democracy. There is no democracy in the Gulf area. But yet we let these countries stay. We let these countries maintain their power. You know, one family controlled the whole country.
The United States, is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we're gonna look at the region, it's not going to be stable if we don't have the same position toward all countries. We led Saudi Arabia to invade Yemen right now and try to stabilize Yemen. Well, we created a mess. You know, it's not happening. And the region is going to explode. Mm-hmm. I'm not optimistic like my friends here. I see things going from bad to worse. And I hope I'm wrong.
Let's get back to these local events that we've introduced the show with, and that's the Chapel Hill shootings where the students were killed and the Charlotte family that was shot at 18 times, and one woman had a wound in the leg. The Islamic Center of Charlotte had a news conference right after that event in Charlotte. Why? Were you trying to quell further violence? Were you trying to explain what had happened here or put it into some sort of perspective? Why?
We demand justice when something wrong like this happened, when people are getting killed execution style. You know, we need to bring awareness from the communities we are living in to these events. We are not trying to start anything. You know, we're not trying to start a riot. We're not trying to start any movement. We're just asking for, if you want to say, awareness. You know, we need people to be aware that Muslims are not violent. We've been getting shot at. We've been getting killed. And we need everybody to understand that justice has to be served. We live in a country of laws and regulations. We don't want anybody to go out and start killing people. And then we look for an excuse to say, oh, it was over a parking dispute. And we all know it's not true.
That's the Chapel Hill incident.
Yes.
And the father of one of the victims in that said, he used the words you just used a moment ago, that the women in that incident were shot execution style. Does that comment, that description, come from the evidence, or does it come from the emotions of a father who lost his child?
I think from the evidence. Looking at the situation, the first one was killed at the doorsteps, mm-hmm. then further went inside. The second one was killed in the kitchen door, and the third one was killed inside the kitchen, all at the head, with shot straight at the head. So it's not emotional, it's pretty much evidence.
It has yet to be determined whether these are hate crimes. I suppose they appear to be hate crimes. If they are hate crimes, were they, do you think, fueled by a fear of Muslims because some people attach Muslim and Islam to terrorism, or was it fueled simply because they were other, they were not like us?
I think the media plays a big role in fueling this. You know, we listen to the radio sometimes and we hear that Muslims is doing this and Muslims is killing this, and looking at ISIS, looking at the video that they have outside on the media and the social media and on TV that we keep running on this TV shows over and over and again is just fueling this hatred.
We have to take a break. When I come back, I want to talk some more about this incident in Chapel Hill. And then we'll move on to the other problems within the Middle East and our role in all of this as the United States, as an actor over there. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Children's Theater Charlotte, now registering for summer camp and presenting Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat now through Sunday. Tickets available now at ctcharlotte.org. Hannah Blanton is a true believer in the healing power of art. She says art helped her heal from a rare disease that left her immobile. Well, she's back now. She's well. She's running a gallery uptown, and we hear her story in the first part of Charlotte Talks on Monday, and then hear from two successful local artists who have achieved what is almost impossible. They have built full-time careers as artists, and they're getting national recognition. We'll meet them as well Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Baltimore police say they won't release Freddie Gray's death report to the public. The Supreme Court hears arguments on same-sex marriage and lethal injections. And Senator Bernie Sanders says he'll run for president as a Democrat.
The News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the incidents here in the Charlotte area and Chapel Hill and the Middle East and how it all ties together. We have Dr. Abdelmadi Al-Soudi with us. He's a visiting scholar to UNC Charlotte from Jordan University. Sam Wazan is author of Trapped in Four Square Miles and The Last Moderate Muslim. It's actually the same book with different titles because it's different editions. And Neil Abudaba is chairman of the Islamic Center of Charlotte. Sam, according to one news report about the incidences in Chapel Hill, the killings in Chapel Hill, they may not have been directed at those students because they were, well, there's little evidence to prove that it was over a parking dispute, even though that's what the perpetrator says. But it may not have been because they were Muslim, because on his website, on the perpetrator's website, on his Facebook page, he made some statements denigrating Christianity. And in January, he posted this. He said, "People say there is nothing that can solve the Middle East problem. I say there is something, atheism." Mm-hmm. He sees religion as a problem.
And I regret that many folks, not all, I choose my words carefully. I'm just directing that to Dr. Al-Soudi here. Many folks who crossed over to atheism or are not subscribed to a religious affiliation did that as a knee-jerk reaction because religions had historically proven that especially the dysfunctional family members of Abraham, whom I lived around in the Middle East, have proven that religions are a cause of massacres and daily crimes in a region where the most sanctified cities in the world exist. So I don't blame those who walk away, but they are walking away for the wrong reasons.
And we've seen disagreements within religions, not just in the in Islam. It's been throughout history in Christianity, as recently as the Northern Ireland problem, which is fortunately under taps now. But we've seen it in Christianity for years in the Middle Ages. We see it now in Islam. How do you end it?
Well, let's go back to that
question. You have true believers who fervently believe what they believe and have a stake in what they believe. How do you end it?
Religious violence is just the symptom. It's not the root cause. I will assure you that from where I lived and I've seen it. Religion is the most potent cry to rally people around for anything. And I am, again, speaking from experience, having lived inside a combat zone for 15 years. When people are told to go fire around, or let me rephrase, no one will fire around for financial gains or acreage. There are politicians who mastered rallying the masses by augmenting their agendas with religious unity. And that's the most potent cry. So they tell their people that their survival and the survival of their sect or denomination depends on them going to battle. So in my mind, going straight ahead to solve religion's violence is dealing with the symptom, not the problem. The problem is twofold. One, it's from the grassroots up and from the top down. From the top down, we have to work on ending corruption. Ending corruption and finding those local politicians who sold their loyalty to the highest foreign bidder for their interests. And from the bottom up, it's a grassroots movement for educating children and expectant parents who raise their children. I'm talking about not education as in engineering and a doctorate degree or an attorney or doctor. I'm talking about education and civility on a mother and father to raise their child with the intent for that child to live in a state of mutual harmony for all living beings, regardless of any religious, cultural, or ethnic affiliation. That kind of education.
When Saddam Hussein was toppled, when we kind of upset the apple cart in the Middle East, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe this is an American opinion and not an Arab or a Middle East opinion, that we kind of gave birth to Arab Spring. People saw what happened in Iraq, and they wanted a piece of that. They wanted their oppressive regimes gone. And so the people rose up in many countries in the Middle East. But now it's devolved into something that could be even worse than what was there in the first place with the rise of groups like ISIS, which seem to be more brutal, which seem to be more dictatorial than any of the regimes that they are replacing. They filled the vacuum. Could anybody have predicted that?
No, because actually, if you look at this problem here, so when we are talking about religion, conflict or between, for example, Islam and other. So we have in sociology something called we and them. Mm-hmm. So you, when you have a conflict, so you have to look at the people who really like you, that have the same values, the same believing. Mm-hmm. And so we say the Arabs against Israelis, the Arabs against American, Muslims against the Christian. And that's why ISIS is using this this formula that, okay, this Christian American coming to fight the Muslims and occupy them. So this is the way they can really tell those young people that we are defending Islam against those invader or Christian who are coming to occupy our country.
And that's a more popular or a more attractive message than fighting for freedom, fighting for your own personal freedom?
There is no fighting for freedom in that area because they are oppressing the same people. They are under control.
Right, but what I'm saying is during the Arab Spring, yes. People rose up against the regimes in place. In some cases, they were toppled.
Yes.
And in many cases, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other organizations came in and were more brutal and were more attractive to these people. So some people, not all. Why would they be more attractive than what came before if they're rising up against what came before?
Yeah, but you see, in the Arab countries, you see, I wrote an article about how the Arabs feel about their rulers. First of all, we don't have any Arab country which is can we agree that it is a democratic? There is no single Arab country which is qualified to be called a democratic country. Nothing. No. So the rulers of the Arab countries supported, first of all, they are created by the West, supported by the West, and they hate these rulers, and there is no way that they can get rid of them because who trained their forces? Who supplies with them with weapons? The Western. So the Arab people hate their rulers, first of all, then hate the people who really support them. Mm-hmm. So this is the idea. So when the Arab raised up in the Arab Spring, actually when the American came to the Middle East, I was optimistic that, maybe this will be a new era. We just get rid of all these dictators. Then the Americans changed their minds because they found that after the trouble Saddam Hussein, they created Al-Qaeda. Then to deal with a dictator, one person, it is easier for the American leadership to deal with a democratic government like Hamas in West Bank. Once they won the election in the American way or democratic way, they nobody recognized. They even called it a terrorist organization.
So what I'm hearing you say is it's our fault. Is it our fault?
It is, I have to ask you the question, why the American are there? Mm-hmm. Why the American are there? Every American should ask himself, why the American are there? Just to distribute food and education and hospitals and roads? Why are they going there?
I think we went there.
And why?
It's arguably under false pretenses to go into Iraq because we were told that there were weapons of mass destruction. We went into Afghanistan because we were going to punish Al-Qaeda for what they did on 9/11. Now, you can debate how long we've been there and why we should still remain there, but if we pull out, the whole thing will be chaos, won't it?
Yeah, this is not your responsibility. This is the old notion of the colonialism. So we are there just to make you
better. Well, there have been people who say that this is a civil war among followers of Islam between the Sunnis and the Shiites and other branches of Islam, and that we shouldn't be there. We shouldn't be involved. We should let you fight it out until the flame burns.
Let me rephrase. This is the Obama doctrine. Now I agree with him because once you leave the area, let them fight. One part will dominate the area. Then we solve the problem. What's better before during Saddam Hussein, during Gaddafi, or now? I'm talking about the relation between the Arabs and America. In Iraq, there is nothing against America in Iraq before during Saddam Hussein.
Let's talk about
now. We are creating a new thing in the Middle East, and this is the hatred coming to America because they are going now fighting beside the Shia against the Sunni. This is the people there see this. I am not creating from myself. The Arabs or the Muslim people in Syria and Iraq, they're seeing that Americans helping one side against the other. So what's the benefit for America to do this? That's the bigger question.
Let's first of all, when you said you, I'd like to mark this for the record. I am as an American as anyone can be, and I'm proud of my citizenship. And I consider myself an American Lebanese, not Lebanese American, for the record.
Well, by you.
No. I just want to make sure that
I was actually looking at Dr. Al-Soudi because he's from Jordan.
That's right.
But, but just the fact that there are people who say we should let people in that part of the world
right.
solve the problem amongst
here.
Themselves.
Two
you
things
can't
here.
Force a solution on them. They have to solve it
Two
themselves.
Things. One is that I am disgraced. Every time I hear someone blaming his problems on others, and I am disgraced because we never take a stand and say we are strong in principle and we will not allow any other foreign country to intervene in our affairs as a population. And we have the tendency to do that. Arabs in that region where I grew up and I visit there frequently turn to America and blame all their faults and all their shortcomings. And when they look at the mirror and they see themselves struggling and kill each other, they blame America and Israel for their problems. I think people need to look at themselves in the mirror and say, where do I stand? How do I end this? How am I not going to be a victim forever? And the second thing about the part with this is the people... When we say Arab Spring, I never bought into it. When you throw a rope to people who are not
Arab Spring, there was an Arab Mist.
You throw a rope to people and to save them, but they're only skilled at making a noose.
What's the scuttlebutt around the Islamic Center when people come in, followers of Islam? Are they talking about the U.S. involvement in that part of the world? Are they saying it's our fault? Are they saying they should solve the problems themselves? What are they saying?
Our job in all Islamic centers in this country, and you can see I was going to comment on what Sam mentioned a few minutes ago about educating people. Our job here is to educate people. We are very proud in this country that we did not have any issues with Muslims in this country committing any terrorist activity. If you look around, they're all very well-educated people. The centers here play a big role in stabilizing Muslims. When we come and talk, we don't sit and blame America. We're all Americans. Mm-hmm. We're proud American. We will never agree to sit down here and blame American for interfering in the Middle East. We would disagree with certain policy. Why are we alliance with the Saudis or Kuwaitis or the Gulf area, yet we're trying to destabilize.
If you didn't blame America, how do you explain this problem? Please explain me why the people are there
in Islamic
fighting.
Centers in this country, we have to stabilize people. We have to tell
how?
Them what we do. We're not political movement here. Mm. You know, the Islamic centers are not allowed to be involved in politics, but we need to tell them. When we see something, a lot of people start saying, well, ISIS, they are not Muslims. ISIS, they are Muslims. ISIS is, you know, this is what Islam is. And we have to educate people about that.
Let's settle that. Because there are people who say that ISIS is the essence of Islam. They certainly use the Quran to justify a lot of what they do. They persecute people who are not following the law of Islam precisely to the letter that they believe it should be followed. But then there's another group of people that say that ISIS is un-Islamic. So which is it? It either is or it isn't. So which is it?
Well, I want to comment on that. First of all, when ISIS say we are Muslims, we cannot deny that. We don't know if they are Muslims or not, but we're going to have to accept that they are Muslims. The behavior in beheading people, killing people, put it in social media, doing it, you know, broadcast it all over. Is this a religious movement? Is this a religious way on, say, you know, delivering your point? I don't understand it. Mm. There is millions of people are getting killed in monthly basis. And when I say monthly, look at Iraq, Syria. How many people are killed in Syria? We don't see any video for that. We don't see any social media for that. We don't even know about it. But when 20 people are getting prosecuted or killed or executed, it's all over the news for days and days and days. And this is what puts a bad taste of Islam in the mouth of all Americans here.
I like what Niall said about we can't judge what others believe in. I mean, I when I, again, lived during the war, people who terrified me the most mm-hmm. were people who elevated themselves to be in the ranking of God and were judging his creations on his behalf and ruling who was a believer and who's not. So, yes, those guys terrorized me the most. And ISIS gave themselves that status of being the judges of God's creations on earth. And there are people like that that I'm seeing incubated here in the United States. You talked earlier about the shootings in Chapel Hill. And we're talking about how some people commit murders, whether they're atheists or not. I don't think labels matter. I think what matters is that there is a lot of ideological radicalization going on in the United States. And I speak also here from a personal experience. There is the venomous rhetoric and the biased narrative and virtue in geopolitical context that people in the family rooms are using to understand how they can rationalize or think about their anguish, terror, or confusion, and maybe sadness. So they're listening to these nationally syndicated talking heads in the for-profit media, I should say, because they go after ratings and fear is great for it. And these are the people who are incubating future killers of others who don't look like them in the family room. I used to be asked before, after 9/11 it was okay, but after the Boston bombing it got really bad. When people detected an accent on me, and let me tell you, my skin color doesn't give me away. So, but when people detect an accent, say, where are you from? I would say Lebanon. I was born in Lebanon. Before the Boston bombings, people would say, oh, I love tabbouleh, fattoush, kibbeh, all the food, hummus. And then now, the second immediate response is another question, which is, what is your faith? I am terrified that America, a multi-faith nation, is becoming sectarian with that dividing, venomous rhetoric. There are people on the news, and I will tell you clearly, and I'm not going to be abashed on it, and maybe you'll lose 50% of your audience, on Fox News. One guy on the Five show, he said, they come from the desert and we bury our head in the sand here. Who's they? Muslims all over the world. A Muslim in Indonesia is nothing like a Muslim in Turkey. Neither one of them speaks Arabic. And personally speaking, the first time I saw the desert was in 2008 when I was taking my family to the Grand Canyon through Flagstaff. So they're using these broad brush statements and catalyzing a lot of hate here in the United States.
Sam Wazan is the author of The Last Moderate Muslim, which has become trapped in 4 square miles. Nail Abu Dhabi is the chairman of the Islamic Center of Charlotte. And Dr. Abdulmadi Al-Sudi is a visiting scholar from Jordan University, who is in residence at UNC Charlotte. We'll come back and talk more about this in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Queen's University of Charlotte, where the first class of online graduates are walking in commencement this month. Details about all of the 16 graduate degrees on campus and online at queens.edu. And Discovery Place, presenting Illusion, Nothing is as it seems, now on exhibition, gaining insight into the human mind through interactive artwork and demonstrations that playfully distort the senses. More at discoveryplace.org. Baltimore police turn over Freddie Gray's death report to the Maryland State Prosecutor, but not to the public. The Supreme Court hears arguments on same-sex marriage and lethal injections. And Bernie Sanders says he'll run for president as a Democrat. It's the Weekly News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, the National Hour first, the International Hour at 11 o'clock with Susan Page sitting in today for Diane. Want to join our conversation? WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to us, as will WFAE on Facebook or Twitter.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Those of you who know NPR only for its award-winning, globally dominant news quiz, wait, don't tell me, may be surprised to know that every weekday morning, this station broadcasts a remarkable magazine of the day's news with reports from all over the country and the world. NPR, now more than just silly quizzes. Monday is a new day. Start it with Morning Edition. It's also, you know, not a bad show.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are proving in this hour that the Arab world and the Islamic world is not a monolith. there are variations of opinion, strong ones, which is partly what the situation in the Middle East is all about. We have a visiting scholar, we have the head of the Islamic Center, and we have an author with us, all with ties to that part of the world and also ties to Islam. How much of the violence in the Middle East today is really tied to religion versus a struggle for power?
Actually, it is both. It is both. Because, you see, before I go that, ISIS and Islamic, kind of Islamic, they have really very extreme view about how to govern. And that's why it is hated by most of the Arab and Muslim countries at this moment, including Jordan and the whole world. So how they burn that pilot, Jordanian pilot, in the camera. Mm-hmm. So they are not acceptable, but they are Muslims. We cannot deny that they are Muslim, but they are. We have Al-Qaeda, we have Shia, we have Sunni, we have Zaydi, we have Houthi, we have different group Muslims. But every one of them, so when you talk about Islam, I hate to generalize. Like Sami says that all Muslims or Arabs, we cannot generalize. This is the
I'm
most
the one who said you can't generalize. That,
because ISIS actually wants this to be. ISIS, they want the American to say Muslims. Radical Muslims. So you are now generalizing. So you are bringing all the Muslims to their side.
That's
the idea.
ISIS certainly has an agenda. There was a news report, however, over the weekend. I think it was last weekend by a magazine or a newspaper from another part of the world. And they were interviewed on NPR. And it talked about their uncovering a blueprint for the operation, secret documents that were the blueprint for the operations of ISIS, and essentially that their domination plan was not based on Islam. They're using Islam to win over followers so that they can have the power in that part of the world, in the Middle East. Is it simply a power grab? Is it simply a bunch of people who want to be all-powerful and call the shots, and they're using Islam as a means to attract people into the fold?
Of course, that's the right expression. If you remember back years on the 70s when the Soviet Union was strong, people used that, you know, as a flag to gain power. Now it's a new flavor. It's just like flavor of the day. What's the flavor of the day? It's Islam. So let's use that to gain power. So you hit it right on that.
So when they're recruiting people from other parts of the world, from France, from Great Britain, from the United States, there was a young person, I think, in Fort Mill that was discovered perhaps being lured into the ISIS net. What are they seeing as foreign nationals? They're not part of the Middle East. They're part of this country. They're part of France. They may have ties, family ties. And some of them don't. Some of them are pure Americans who have nothing to do with Islam up until a certain point.
They play in with emotions. And
why is it attractive to them? Why?
It come to the point that they showed them what's happening. They showed them that we're going to promise you paradise. We're going to promise you all of this illusion that they promised them. And with the media playing a big role that they are very well-hated people in this country, just come where you are very loved. And that's what's happening. We ask people to come forward. We ask people to work with all Islamic centers to stabilize this. You know, we don't have that many. If you look at USA as a country, we have the least amount of people that went and joined ISIS. Mm-hmm. And that's all because of the leaders in this country. They play a big role, Muslim leaders I'm talking about, in these Islamic centers. They explain to them, and we don't let any of that come close to our, you know, to our cities, because we try to protect our cities. If people in Charlotte know the job we're doing or know the role of the Islamic Center, you know, I think they're all going to come and be part of it, because we are not letting this to come to our neighborhood. We don't agree with it. We don't like it. You know, killing people in the name of Islam or in the name of religion in general is not acceptable.
Let me, if I may, Mike, build on that a little bit. You asked about, is ISIS using this as a power grab? And I want to comment on the second thing about why people go and join ISIS. Power grab, in my experience, when I saw, and I speak, it's in the novel, when I saw this in Lebanon, and I noticed that pattern, the wars stopped only when the return on investment of reconstruction was higher than the rate of return on destruction.
I read that. You wrote that down someplace, and I read it, and I think it's really kind of interesting. What you're saying is that the profit motivation
of course.
is in operation here. If it's more profitable to wage war than it is to rebuild
after
a war,
that's right.
That's where the balance
that's
is.
Right. When there's nothing left, when there was nothing left to destroy in Lebanon, then they said, well, if we rebuild it and give all these warlords— The warring factions. Mm-hmm. A guy came from the outside, Rafiq Hariri, the former prime minister who got assassinated. He came in and he paid off the warlords. And I might get assassinated when I go back to Lebanon if you air that there somewhere. But anyway, they paid all the warlords off. They all have ministries, and it's nepotism on steroids. The Shiites have one, the Sunnis have one, and every denomination and sect has one. So when there was nothing left to destroy and they can make more money and have shares in a reconstruction of a city called Solidaire, that was the company, then it stopped. And in no one's interests right now, it's in no one's interest to start a war because they all have big investments. The second thing on why people join ISIS, let's talk about the people who outsourced their convictions wherever they live, to that region or to a cause, outsourced convictions, and they come in from all walks of life. There are people who join different kinds of militias and different kinds of organizations that are like ISIS or not like ISIS, but they are not, for the record, self-radicalized. Mm-hmm. They were raised to be radical ideologically to one day, unpredictable to anyone, internally turn that into militant radicalism.
Let me bring this back home for just a couple of seconds and talk again to Neil Abu Dhabi from the Islamic Center for just a moment, because you said something that people need to hear, and that is that within your center, within other centers and perhaps mosques around the country, you're saying that leaders in Islam in America are telling young people and other people that this is not what we believe. This terrorist activity, this what's happening with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, this is not what we believe. And you're trying to talk people some sense into people, letting them see the reality of what's actually going on. One of the criticisms of the Islamic world in this country after 9/11, perhaps even after the Boston massacre or the Boston bombings, rather, and after some of the beheadings that have taken place in the Middle East at the hands of ISIS, is that the Islamic leadership is not more vocal about condemning these acts. You're saying that you are. You're just doing it among people who might be lured into that world.
Well, the behaviors, the what we see on cameras, we are 100% against it. Because even when a killing takes place on camera, it meant to terrorize people. And that's what I'm talking about. I mean, ISIS as a behavior.
But are you...
We don't kill people in the name of Islam. This is completely unacceptable.
Okay, but are you vocal enough in the secular world, in the outside world? Because when people see this, when people who are have a screw loose or a little unbalanced, and they see what happens at the hands of ISIS, or they see the Trade Center going tumbling to the ground with thousands of people being killed at the same time, they think, I need to revenge this. I need to do something. I need to act out against any follower of Islam that I find. And that's why we have these hate crimes that crop up. If your organizations were more vocal in the secular arena, would that not quell some of that?
When September 11 happened, nobody agreed to it. Everybody went and condemned the attack. I mean, we are all Americans, and souls that have been killed here were Americans. So nobody agreed to it, you know, and we were very strong. All the leaders in this country went out and, you know, condemned the attack. Mm-hmm. What's happening with ISIS? We really don't understand. People want us to talk about ISIS, and we don't know who they are, what they're doing. They are, you know, talk to us about stuff that takes place here. But to come and ask me to talk about ISIS, I did not give them, you know, reason to go and kill people. So now you're asking me, who are they? Talk about them. I don't know them. We are Americans. We talk about stuff that when you brought 9/11, it happened in this ground, in this country. But when you talked about ISIS, I'm not very well educated about Iraq or Syria to talk about it.
But getting back to what Sam said, after 9/11, they were saying one thing. After the Boston bombing, they were asking what faith he was. Alarming. So obviously Islam is being tarnished by some of these and grossly misunderstood by others, which in some cases can lead to violence against followers.
But when Boston bombing happened, every single mosque condemned the attack. Again, it happened on American soil. We're gonna speak our opinion. But to talk about something that takes place in thousands of miles away, that we don't know what the motive is, what their political view is, why they're doing that, we cannot.
Mike, go ahead.
Mike, there is something that we need to understand, that the peacemaking industry is a nonprofit industry. There are no weapons for peace. So when you got somebody talking about peace all day long, he's not going to get coverage, or she. Mm-hmm. What's happening is that you need deep marketing budgets and a prestigious PR firm to get coverage. If you want to talk about something related to this is who we are as members of the community at large in the United States, you need to have that. Without money, you won't get exposure. And ratings are driven up by fear. Look, those three were journalists who traveled to the Middle East. By the way, I was in Damascus, Syria, during the same time that journalist Foley was abducted. Mm-hmm. They showed and talked about the slaying and the slitting of the throats of these journalists over and over, those who opted to be there for days. And CNN followed because they were losing ratings. And it was like running war infomercials. And as soon as Obama buckled and scrambled jets, we transitioned back to the Cosby affairs and the new exposure. What we found, a new woman came along and she said, I went. So we are at a disadvantage when you want to talk about something that is lame like peace. There is no money for that. Yeah. If Martin Luther King existed today, Gandhi or Mandela today, started over, they will need marketing money for Facebook, for Twitter. They need to have a team working like a machine 24/7. This is not going to happen. There are many people like Neil who are speaking out in the world about this. People are not Islam. They are a few Muslims who are doing this.
Dr. Al-Sudi.
We are actually looking for solutions. We just want to. We are not interested in blaming this side or that side. So the bigger question here is: so why are this a problem between the Muslims and America? This is the critical question. As long as the American are there and using their planes to bomb those people, what do you expect from the rest of the people? So I'm not saying that they are supposed to kill American. No, I am just trying as a sociologist to explain the problem. So instead of blaming each other, so the best solution for this problem to end, because there is no genetic hatred between the Muslims and the Americans or other nations. So there is a real problem there. The American airplanes now bombing many parts of the Arab countries and the Muslim countries. So they are killing people. And the last time they killed even Americans. So this is the real problem. We have to think about this. How the American can really get rid of that anti-Americanism from this area by pulling themselves out of this area. If they spend the money, $100 billion Americans spent in the Iraqi army, and in 24 hours, it is gone. The ISIS occupied the whole area. So instead of investing in war and helping Shia against Sunni, Sunni against Shia, pumping the people, they're supposed to provide them with maybe economic aid, education, hospitals, roads. Then, as he said, Sam, if you really do these economic things, maybe the whole problem will end by itself. There is no way that they will continue hating each other.
For your audience to know afterwards,
Islam is not Islam as a Muslim. This is very fact. Islam, Muslim. We are required by our religion to recognize Judaism, to recognize Christianity as our own religion. But because of these wars, we are confused. Everybody is trying to generalize all Muslim radical Islams, and it is hating everyone.
I like to say that whether, and I am okay, born into the Islamic faith, I would say whether the Quran tells me or not, I will respect and accept Jews, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, and people of all affiliations and ethnicities. So, but I want to go back to the point that I agree with Dr. Al Saud here. And for your audience, if they don't know this, when we, if we come across as arguing, what we do, ethnically speaking, at the end, hug and kiss and say, good to see you, brother. And we go separate ways. But the thing is here with what he said, when those fighting there fatigue from warring each other and raise their eyes to Washington for help, like Dr. Al Saud said, Washington needs to say no more supplying you and selling you weapons. It ends here, because what we're doing now, we're enablers. Not only Washington is an enabler, people in this country are unknowingly feeding the fire. We are an economic power. We have deeper pockets and we enable. And I'm talking about people of all affiliations. I'm not singling any religious sect, denomination, or a group. We are enablers. They come to us for support. And we're smart people. We're problem solvers. But somehow, we made heritage the culprit of daily violence where we outsourced our convictions. We need to stop and think. For example, in the Middle East and the Arab world, wherever the conflicts are, don't ask me for one more dime. We've been doing this for over 60 to 70 years and nothing changed. And Einstein said it. Doing the same thing over and over is the definition of insanity.
And you get the last word. Sam Wazin, author of Trapped in Four Square Miles, Neil Abudaba, the chairman of the Islamic Center of Charlotte, and Dr. Abdelmadeh Al-Soudi, visiting scholar at UNC Charlotte and professor at Jordan University. Lively hour. Thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings LLP, a full-service law firm whose lawyers are industry professionals experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation. Details at babc.com.